Hello, you're tuned to Truth News Radio Australia on this Wednesday, the 14th of July, 2010. Tonight I've got two guests coming on. My regular guest and contributor Josh Jackson will be on in about 20 minutes. And we've got Bronwyn Hancock coming on. Bronwyn is someone with a long experience researching vaccines and the problems and dangers of vaccination, and she's going to be coming on to basically fill out some information in regard to a story that has broken in the news in the last 24 hours in relation to an investigative report that was done into a vaccine awareness group called the Australian Vaccination Network. The group is actually led by a woman by the name of Meryl Dory, who lives in the north coast of New South Wales. And this report, which has been issued by a government body, has made a number of claims against her, basically asserting that she is a healthcare provider and that she's providing misinformation, and they've actually made some recommendations which may end up being enforced legally, that she has to put disclaimers on her website. So we'll be talking about that later on in the show. But in the meantime, we'll be giving you some of the top stories from the Twitter stream. I just want to lead with some Australian matters. First, some good news. The internet filter is apparently now well on the back burner. Several reports came out during the week indicating that the government has finally realised that they can't continue with this. I'm just playing you a piece here from Fairfax Media.
Communications Minister Stephen Conroy has announced that his widely criticised internet filtering plan will be delayed until next year. The plan, which involved the mandatory blocking of a secret list of websites, was regarded by critics as a form of censorship that also had the potential to slow down the internet for all Australians.
We don't believe it's old style to want to ban access to child pornography images. We don't believe it's old style to ban images of bestiality or extreme violence or pro-rape websites. We don't believe that's old school at all.
The announcement of the delay comes only a week after Senator Conroy told journalists that the government's commitment to the web filter remained unchanged under new Prime Minister Julia Gillard.
We have an election promise that we're going to keep. We went to the election.
But the filter isn't off the table altogether. The delay is designed to allow for a review of how online content is classified. Until then, some of Australia's largest internet service providers have pledged to voluntarily filter child exploitation material, a move that has been welcomed by both the government and industry.
Okay, that was a report there from Fairfax Media, and there's an article that goes with it. Now, this is quite good news, but it's not. It shouldn't be construed as a victory from the point of view of free speech, because in no sense has the government capitulated to the civil liberties concerns about the censorship. They are obviously aware that it's extremely unpopular. And what they've done is actually kind of cheeky, in my opinion. You know, they've basically backed off without admitting it. And one gets the impression that they're sort of waiting for the opportunity to bring it back. And I strongly suggest that they will do that in the wake of some new crisis that may develop within the next year or so. There could be some terrorist threat or it may be something to do with child pedophile networks, or it could be a number of different things. But quite often we see with the control paradigm under which the encroaching totalitarianism under which we live works, is that they wait for an event or a crisis to occur, which can then be the trigger to bring in the more draconian moves that they actually intended to bring in all the time. Okay, some more good news. The carbon carbon trading has been the emissions trading scheme has been put firmly on the back burner. However, this is tempered by some rather unpleasant news, which is actually coming from the power industry. The power industry is warning both major parties that delaying a carbon price will cause electricity generators to take a stopgap investment decision that will push up power prices anyway. The prediction comes as Federal Cabinet prepares to debate on Tuesday how to clarify its emissions trading scheme delay to give businesses greater certainty about exactly when it will face a price on greenhouse emissions. Several ministers want a clear commitment that Labor will legislate a carbon price during a second term, and Cabinet will consider processes to include business groups in final decision-making and to create community consensus. Now, again, this is good news mixed with bad. And the same pattern we see here that we see with the pulling back on the internet filter while trying to find ways to move ahead with it. Although in this case, it looks worse to me, because we've really got clearly powerful corporate players who are absolutely incensed that this scheme hasn't gone through. And they're basically blackmailing the government and the people of this country by threatening to put up our power prices anyway. Words fail me in terms of conveying the criminality, the underlying ruthlessness of such an approach. But of course, we've come to accept it. We've come to sort of these kind of threatening, belligerent, bullying tactics have just become so normalized now that most people will barely bat an eyelid. But this is what's happening. So have a look at this article. Carbon delay could push up power prices. Basically, I'm just reading here through the article. The chief executive of the Energy Supply Association said that if there was no clear carbon constraint within the next few years, generators would be forced to make stopgap investments in technologies like open cycle gas turbines to meet increases in demand, rather than take long-term, large-scale investment decisions. Well, I mean, that's just a nonsense. It's a complete non sequitur. It's an abuse of language and logic to say that because the government isn't going to bring in their forced price hike due to the price being set on carbon or a tax being applied to carbon, they themselves are going to be forced to do things that is going to force the price up. And who's forcing them? It doesn't even say. It just says they would be forced. Now, it looks to me as if they're actually conflating some quite different factors into this one statement. There is a reason why the energy supply industry is going to have to increase its capacity. That's because we have a rapidly growing population in Australia. And that's something I'm going to be talking about in a bit when Josh comes on board, because this rapid population growth is also government policy, and it is putting a massive strain on every part of our infrastructure, of our society. And yes, without proper measures taken to adapt to this, prices are going to suddenly go up. But in the long term, prices shouldn't be higher. They should actually, having more people should actually in the end make this kind of thing cheaper. And I'm neither for nor against immigration. My whole policy or my views about this is that immigration can be a great thing. But to have immigration but without having any sensible policy for dealing with that, for accommodating it, is actually just extremely reprehensible, extremely negligent. It's just and it really will create a disaster for our country. But that is a separate topic, and we won't get into that just yet. Okay, another story from Australia, which we'll probably pick up again in the last segment tonight. More than 4 out of 10 healthcare workers do not get an influenza vaccination, despite working closely with ill or vulnerable people. The latest data show that in 2008 and 2009, an average of just over 58% of workers were immunised. The Children, Youth and Women's Health Service, which includes the Women's and Children's Hospital, has the second lowest level of worker immunisation uptake. Now, isn't it interesting? Because we hear a lot about vaccines and the importance of vaccines, and we hear a lot of criticism of the fringe groups out there who, you know, refuse to be vaccinated, and we are led to believe that they indeed are just the crazy fringe, and that sensible people, and you'd certainly expect healthcare workers, you know, certainly doctors, you'd expect them to get vaccinated, wouldn't you? Well, overall, healthcare workers have an average of just 58%. That's certainly for the influenza vaccination. I'd be very interested to know what the factors are for other forms of vaccination, including children of healthcare workers, because I've heard anecdotally that many doctors actually don't get their own kids vaccinated for the standard vaccines that are part of the health schedule, the vaccine schedule for kids. And it really highlights a giant gap in awareness within our society when you've got a lower level of vaccination in the most knowledgeable and groups that are the most in the best position to get the vaccine. And when they're not taking the vaccine, you know what that means? It means there's something wrong with the vaccine. But of course, this article, if you read it through, it indicates that there's something wrong with the healthcare workers. It disappoints me considerably that these healthcare workers are not accepting their duty of care to be vaccinated to protect the vulnerable, particularly children and those with chronic illnesses. Indeed. So we've clearly got some issues there. Okay, just moving on with some international news. The Iraq Inquiry in the UK has found that the government intentionally and substantially exaggerated the WMD threat. Tony Blair's government intentionally and substantially exaggerated the threat from Saddam Hussein ahead of the war in Iraq, a former senior British diplomat has claimed. Khan Ross, who was the first secretary responsible for the Middle East at the United Nations, accused the former government of issuing lies to the public about the dictator's capacity to launch weapons of mass destruction. He said that it was a disgrace that ministers failed to exhaust all peaceful options before going to war against Iraq. There was no deliberate discussion of available alternatives to military action, in advance of the 2003 invasion, Mr. Ross added. There is no record of that discussion, and no official has referred to it, no minister has talked about it, and that seems to me to be a very egregious absence in this history, that at some point a government, before going to war, should stop and ask itself, are there available alternatives? Well, I'll leave that article there on the show notes for you to have a look at. It's a very important part of the ongoing quest for justice in the whole spectrum of what happened after 9/11, and I don't minimise it at all. Some people would say, oh, it doesn't matter, you know, it's so long ago now. Well, they say that about 9/11. If you don't get justice, if you don't pursue justice, there will never be peace. Because, and I'm not saying that the people concerned have to be, you know, thrown in prison for the rest of their lives or executed or any of those kind of things. There has to be a sense of justice. Those who are essentially war criminals, like Tony Blair, finally have to be outed. And then they do have to lose the respect and privilege that they've wrongfully earned in our society simply by you know, virtue of being leaders. They're murderers and they're criminals. They've committed crimes against humanity. And these processes of inquiries eventually need to lead to that final sense that those people are no longer held up in any way, and no longer in the same way that we don't hold up Adolf Hitler or Mussolini or Stalin or people like that. We don't hold up people who had the position of being leaders as being anything other than what they really are. If they've committed these crimes, then they are quite simply criminals. Okay, I just quickly want to play a short piece here from Veterans Against the War, which again plays into the subject I was just referring to earlier. And this is about... the title is Racism and War, the Dehumanization of the Enemy. And this is an extremely passionate, extremely articulate speech from a former soldier who describes a mission he took part in with his unit in Iraq. And I'll just play a bit here for you.
My name is Mike Preisner. I joined the Army, left for basic training on my 18th birthday in June of 2001. I was assigned to the 10th Mountain Division, and in March of 2003, I was attached to the 173rd Airborne Brigade and deployed to northern Iraq. So when I first joined the Army, we were told that racism no longer existed in the military. A legacy of inequality and discrimination was suddenly washed away by something called the Equal Opportunity Program. We would sit through mandatory classes, and every unit had this EO representative to ensure that no elements of racism could resurface. And the Army seemed firmly dedicated to smashing any hint of racism. And then September 11th happened, and I began to hear new words like towel head and camel jockey and the most disturbing, sand nigger. And these words did not initially come from my fellow soldiers, but from my superiors, my platoon sergeant, my company first sergeant, battalion commander. All the way up the chain of command, these terms, these viciously racist terms, were suddenly acceptable. And I noticed that the most overt racism came from veterans of the first Gulf War. And those were the words they used when they were incinerating civilian convoys. Those are the words they used when this government deliberately targets civilian infrastructure, bombing water supplies, knowing that it would kill hundreds of thousands of children. Those are the words the American people used when they allowed this government to sanction Iraq. And this is something that many people forget, and we can't forget, is that we've just learned that we've killed over a million Iraqis since this invasion, but we already killed a million Iraqis in the 90s through sanctions and bombings prior to this invasion, so the number truly is much higher. But when I got to Iraq in 2003, I learned a new word, and that word was Haji. Haji was the enemy. Haji was every Iraqi. He was not a person, a father, a teacher, or a worker. And it's important, we've heard this word a lot during Winter Soldier, but it's important to understand where this word came from. And to Muslims, the most important thing is to take a pilgrimage to Mecca, it's the Hajj. And someone who has taken this pilgrimage is a Haji. And it's something that in traditional Islam is the highest calling in the religion. So we took the best thing for a Muslim and made it into the worst thing. But history did not start with us. And since the creation of this country, racism has been used to justify expansion and oppression. The Native Americans were called savages. The Africans were called all sorts of things to excuse slavery. And Vietnam veterans know of the multitude of words used to justify that imperialist war. So Haji was the word we used. It was the word we used on this particular mission I'm going to talk about. And we've heard a lot about different raids and kicking down the doors of people's houses and ransacking their houses. But this mission was different, a different kind of raid. I never got any explanation for these orders. We were only told that this group of houses, five or six houses, were now property of the U.S. military, and we had to go in and make those families leave those houses. So we went to these houses and informed the families that those homes were no longer their homes. We provided them no alternative, nowhere to go, no compensation, and they are very confused and very scared and did not know what to do and would not leave, so we had to remove them from those houses. One family in particular, a woman with two small girls, a very elderly man, and two middle-aged men, we dragged them from their houses and threw them onto the street and arrested the men because they refused to leave, arrested the old man, and sent them off to prison. And at that time, I didn't know what happened to people when we tied their hands behind their back and put a sandbag on their head. But unfortunately, a few months later, I had to find out. We were short interrogators, so I was assigned to work as an interrogator.
I'm just going to leave it there. I do strongly recommend watching the rest of that video. It's a really, really harrowing account there that he gives. And he's really passionate and articulate in the way he describes it. It really made me feel some pretty strong emotions when I listened to that today. So I'll leave that there for you on our show notes. Now, I'm just going to cross now to Josh Jackson. Please stand by. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia. Going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now. And welcoming to the show, Josh Jackson. How are you, Sir Josh?
Oh, I'm wonderful. Another glorious week.
Glorious week. I've got no complaints other than, you know, my general complaint. My series of complaints. I don't have any personal complaints. You know, I just shifted my focus to just complain about much bigger issues than you know I used to be concerned with.
It's important to look on the positive side as well. And
I try to do that. I went through a couple of stories tonight before you came on board that you know we've got some things to be pleased with. We're not getting an internet filter. And when we're not getting an ETS for now, that's the kicker. Yeah, that's
just before the election, of course.
Yes.
You don't want to do unpopular things that you know is unpopular. I mean, it just spells undemocratic to me.
It does.
I mean, they obviously know it's unpopular, so they'll wait till after the election to do it. I mean, to me, that's the most undemocratic thing you could ever do, and everyone should be riled up.
I mean, I call it downright cheeky.
Yeah.
But look, Josh, you've been investigating housing affordability in our great city of Sydney in Australia.
Yeah.
What have you come up with?
Well, I mean, I've really noticed a massive inflation in terms of rental properties just in the last sort of, you know, four or five years. Over the last 4 or 5 years, it's gone up, you know, a couple of $100s a week, or maybe $150 to $150 on average per week. I mean, you know, when I was,
indeed,
I mean, it's unbelievable. I've been looking for, the reason why I've been investigating it is because I'm looking for a new apartment.
Absolutely.
And man, like, you know, two years ago, maybe 3 years ago, I could easily find somewhere for around $330, a one bedroom little place, you know,
yeah,
in a Sydney, around Sydney, out sort of inner west, up north shore. So not slap bang right in the middle, but you know, a little bit out. And it was fine. I mean, I got an apartment 3 years ago, right in the middle of Sydney, 330, one bedroom, nice place, modern, all the mod cons, you know, dishwashers and all that.
Sure.
No way nowadays. You can hardly even see anything for 330 online, unless you get getting some like ridiculous studio apartment, which is, you know, a bed next to the, you know, so you cook your meal and then a bit of the fat splats onto your bed because it's right next to it. I mean, and then the toilet. I mean, it's literally a prison cell.
Now, look, and here's the problem, folks. And I really wish this were not so, but it's all very well if prices go up and our incomes go up and, you know, that's inflation, I guess, and we sort of just live with it. And then, you know, the prices go down again when there's deflation. But this is not what's happening. What's happening is we've got totally asymmetrical changes here. We've got the price of accommodation just skyrocketing. We've got people's actual income either staying static or actually going down. I know people, yeah, who've actually had their pay cut.
Well, I know that the where I work, there's been a total pay freeze for the last 3 years. No one's, even GDP pay raises have gone.
That's extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, and it's everywhere. Yet rents just keep on going up. And look, I haven't got a problem getting paid well. It's all good for me, but I really feel for the families who have to pay for child support and everything else on top of, you know. And if they're not lucky enough to buy somewhere, which is a trap in itself because the mortgages are so extraordinary. I mean, the medium house prices, if you're not renting, if you're in the buyer's market, is $1 million now in Sydney. The medium.
Well, it's
the average.
It's outside of. It's become almost like something out of a Charles Dickens novel. You know what I mean?
No.
I don't know. I'm just trying to highlight the disparity.
Yeah.
In wealth, I mean, because there are people who can buy those sort of houses, but most people can't. There are extremely wealthy people out there who can buy a house like that without, you know, without sort of being on an impossible kind of mortgage situation, but the average person simply can't do it. So we've just got a situation where there's an elite that is insanely wealthy, and a lot of these places are actually being bought from overseas. We know that. We know that the way in which our economy works is that people can come in and just buy properties here. And that's always been forcing the prices up because they come in with offshore money. But I just want to point out one other thing, which is my theory that I actually raised earlier in the show tonight when I was looking at a story that said that the energy companies in Australia have said that even if they don't bring in an emissions trading scheme, they're going to push the price of electricity up anyway. And they gave a really weird explanation for it. They said, oh, we're going to have to invest in all this new technology to deal with demand, right?
Mm.
Now, that's got nothing to do with climate change. I mean, climate change isn't going to make people want more electricity.
No.
Unless they were implying that it's going to get hotter and people are going to have their air conditioners on more, I don't know. I mean, but they certainly didn't spell that out. But here's what I think there is actually some reality behind this. We have a rapidly growing population in this country, and
yeah,
we have zero planning to deal with it. So
exactly.
You're going to get...
It really is like that. There is no,
yeah,
you know, and this is, you know, there's not enough land released. There's all these other fun and games involved. But in terms of a day-to-day renter, I mean, it really is almost impossible because you get What's really hard as a renter, on top of all this, is you get 15 minutes to look at a place. So,
right.
So you're racing around. You can hardly get in to a place because they open it for 15 minutes, and you have to, you know, and they're all open at once. So it's and it's only on Saturday, and then you get in there and you look around, and some of the places, honestly, Harold, were like Russian prisons. They were so dirty and filthy, asking $450 a week. And literally the oldest stove from the 1950s, electric stove in there, you know, what are you meant to do with that? You can't even sort of
right.
get rid of it.
Right.
But this is sort of the ridiculousness of what's going on. Like.
Can you just repeat the sort of prices we're talking about here for a one-bedroom?
Well, this was actually a two-bedroom, but
right.
it was $450.
Right, yeah.
So on average, you're looking for something decent,
yeah.
slightly, you know, you're looking around about $450 for a two-bedroom place or a one-bedroom place even, to be honest. You're looking around about $400.
Well, you see, that's really not affordable. You know, it's just not affordable. Like, it's the incomes haven't, our incomes haven't increased to make that to compensate for that, so I just don't know what to say. I mean, there's something's got to give. There's going to be a catastrophe coming.
Well, I you know what's going to happen is a lot more people are just going to end up buying camper vans and stuff,
right?
And caravans and you'll get sort of tent cities, because at the end of the day, if you can't afford to live somewhere, you can't afford it. And,
well, this is why I call it Dickensian, Josh. You know Charles Dickens, Oliver Twist.
Yeah,
you know,
this is
what the society was like in the 19th century. Just totally outrageous disparity, and how could we, after all this time, after all this history, be heading back in that direction again? I don't think we are. I think we're going to turn it around. That's what I say.
Well, you know, I mean, when you look around through Sydney, everyone seems fairly wealthy. We've all got amazing cars. But this is, again, living on this credit, this cheap credit that's been around. And but what really surprises me is, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine who lives up Byron Bayway, and this is more with purchases. But if there's a property over $1 million or $1 million plus, they just don't sell. They've just been sitting there for a year,
right.
unsold, and people just refuse to sell for less because they want that profit. And it sort of makes me wonder, well, when is Australia's bubble going to burst or deflate? Because, you know, at the end of the day, you can't have people. I mean, people are going to basically, they're not going to cut out from their, because they need somewhere to live, so they're going to cut down on food, on other essentials,
sure.
before they do with rent. So that they, you know, I know a lot of people that are basically paying a lot of rent and eat the crappiest of food. They eat white bread just, you know, hardly anything. And these are people renting. So and some of my friends that have purchased are in real trouble. You know, some aren't. Some are doing well, but.
That's really sad, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really sad. They don't have a life when they've bought in Sydney. They, you know, you ask them to come out to a movie. Oh no, they just can't. They just can't afford it. And you know what's really bad is the children that have to suffer along it. Now the thing is, a lot of this has to do with government policies of subsidising, of manipulating markets, of keeping both sides of the camp happy. So the government go around, they say, oh, we're going to give, you know, housing affordability, we're going to give all these, you know, first homeowners grants and all this sort of stuff. And all that does is raise the property prices by the amount of the homeowners grant is. So if the homeowners grant is $40,000,
yeah.
you know, over time, the property prices of houses go up. $40,000.
And in fact, that
just adjusts to this free money that's coming into it.
That increase of the grant that they did, in fact, created a price spiral, didn't it? It just created a spiral upwards.
Not only that, you get all these people, you know, thinking, oh, now they can afford to buy. So they yeah. do, and now they're in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, because it artificially set the price higher. Now the grant's gone. What's going to happen? It can only really go down. But the population growth, and I do suspect that there's reasons why they've ratcheted up immigration, because by having population growth, it does create does force a situation of economic growth. But then you've got to do it sensibly. I mean, I think part of what's going on here is it's insane.
But this is the problem with central planning. You can't do it sensibly. Nobody knows the answers.
Right.
How in God's great world is somebody so magnificently brilliant that they can orchestrate a marketplace? They can't. They can manipulate to try and help small pressure lobby groups and building unions and stuff like that. And then do quick pork barreling before elections. That's all they can do. And so this whole sort of notion that, we need, central bank to pull the lever of interest rates to orchestrate our economy is absolutely false, because what's happening is we're just building bubbles within bubbles within bubbles. It's, bringing cane toads to fight off... The other thing, you get other problems of the cane toads, and then you get other problems on top of that when you try to fight them, and then it's a sort of spiral.
Yeah, that's certainly a lot of that going on, and the tendency for power to be centralized, and for us to take that for granted as being acceptable in some ways, actually goes against the concept of what those entities were actually really there for. And I'm going to be bringing this up a bit later when I get Bronwyn Hancock on, because when we see government bodies that are set up for a particular purpose being kind of bent into another purpose, which ends up being coercive, It seems like there's this tendency that happens, and a lot of people aren't aware of it, because for some reason they've been deluded into thinking that coercion was actually part of what society was all about, and they forgot what they should have learned in school, that we actually are a democracy, meaning we rule ourselves, we do not have masters, right? But a lot of people in our society are stuck in this child's view of the world, where they actually think that there are masters out there, and that they are like children, and that they have to do what mummy or daddy says.
Well, I think that's very poignant, and where it comes down to is the parenting of children. When parents are so strict and constantly on the ruling over their children, as soon as the children flee the nest. Then the kids go to school. They get ruled by the state in that way.
Yeah.
You have to put your hand up to go to the toilet to do a natural bodily function. You have to, you can't just... You basically are totally controlled. And then what happens in adulthood, what do you do? All of a sudden you're free? No, I need someone to look after me. I can't have this freedom. It becomes stressful just to be totally free. So I think, so then we demand that government take control of a lot of our lives. Property prices are going down. How dare the government let this? I've invested all my money into property prices. And then the other side, property prices are too high. How can we afford properties at this? So the government's trying to centralize and keep control of all these different pressure groups.
And so people want to turn to the government and they want to say, help us, rescue us, save us. So the government says, yes, we'll come in. And guess what? They turn into being abusers. They turn into being actually a new problem that's actually as bad as or worse. It becomes the whole problem. It becomes the problem.
Oh, exactly.
I mean, I just want to quickly read to you a story here that actually perfectly illustrates this. It's actually on our Twitter stream, and the title of the article is "A Few Blocks, 4 Years, 52,000 Police Stops," and it's about police brutality in Brooklyn, in New York. Mm. Now, the important thing about this story is that there are many people in Brooklyn, in New York, who would like to have cops on the beat walking around so that they're safe, right? Yeah. A lot of people think having police walking around is actually a good idea, you know, because in case something bad happens, they're there to protect you, you know? They're going to stop the bad guy. If the bad guy pulls a gun on you, they'll pull a gun on the bad guy.
Let's think about that logically, though. I mean, logically,
yeah.
I bet you anyone in our audience, what is the likelihood that if something bad is happening, there's a cop there to stop it? It's zilch. It's maybe 0.001%. Now, how many people have actually had that happen to? Now, how many times how many people have had cops harass them?
Well, see,
bet it's everyone. I bet it's 99% of people have had a policeman totally harass the heck out of them.
And that's exactly what's been happening in Brooklyn, is that instead of just doing what they were supposed to do, which is just be there as a presence in case something goes wrong, they just walk around harassing people.
Yeah.
They just randomly stop people, search them, you know, and you know, demand to know where they're going.
Yeah.
All this pointless. There was one story here. They, you know, just it's just ridiculous. They're constantly trying to think of new things to do to just invade people's life. And now people are saying we don't want it anymore. You know, you're not helping. You're not protecting us. You're just abusing us and harassing us. Go away. You know,
just go away. You're just another gang in a uniform. You know, I mean, literally, Harold, I have in my life, and this is not because I hate police. I've actually got two friends that are police.
Yeah.
But it's that the whole concept of the police force is it's good in a lot of ways, but what's in practice, what's happening is I'm just never seeing them helpful. I mean, the other day I needed it was actually a few months back. I needed a signature from a Justice of the Peace.
Sure.
So I thought, right, I'll go down to the police station. Big sign on the front of the police station. A, it's all closed up and like you can't see anyone. It's not friendly at all.
Mm.
Then there's this big sign saying, no Justice of the Peace signatures will be given here. Please see, you're up the road at the real estate agent or someone else. And you're just thinking, God, the only time I actually want you guys, you refuse. I mean, every police has to be a Justice of the Peace, by the way, folks. Every policeman. It's just part of their job. And so, but, you know, they just don't want to do it. They don't want people coming in there. They don't want to be helpful and actually do something like signing a piece of paper. They could employ some young cadet, you know, to do that. No way, you know. And then I was woken up rudely at like 4 in the morning. These people are constructing a huge place across the road from me, and they started delivering all these bricks and stuff at 3-4 in the morning, and I thought, this is not on. You know, there's times. So I thought, I'll ring the police.
Right,
if there's a party, you ring the police.
Yeah.
You know, if there's noise pollution. I rang the police. Oh, no, there's not really anything we can do about that.
Well, that's outrageous. If there was someone having a party, they'd come out and stop it.
Oh, they'd come out straight away, and they'd knock on the door. They'd tell you to turn the music down. And
then they'd tase you if you didn't behave.
Well, nowadays, probably. But, you know, it's this sort of notion, and it got me thinking, like, how many times has a policeman actually helped me? And I've got to say, it's maybe been once when I've, you know, had a car accident or something, and I had to go and sign some things. But even then,
well, actually,
really, I
had a friendly visit from a young policewoman not that long ago, who found my wallet in the street, and she actually delivered it to my door.
Wow! Well, that's
I was really pleased with that, and I thanked her, you know.
Yeah.
And that's the sort of thing that's never happened to me before. I've lost my wallet a few times. I've never had that. This was like maybe some experiment they're trying, but gee, you know,
well,
that's actually pretty good.
I've had two citizens do that as well.
Yeah, great. Yeah, I mean, it's you know, we should all take more care. Look, we're going to have to break, Josh. I've got Bronwyn Hancock coming on to talk about some really heavy stuff. So, look, thanks a lot for tonight. We will
no
catch
worries,
up with folks. You again very soon.
Hey, what I'd like to do also is just quickly before we go is ask our audience to, you know, jump on the net and say, you know, what the general house rental prices around their area are, and if they've gone up or down.
Excellent. Yeah, let's get some data on that, and yeah. And we'll keep tracking it.
All right.
Okay.
Till next week, guys.
Yeah. Thanks a lot. Cheers.
Bye.
Okay, we're just going to take a short break and we'll have a bit of music, and then we'll have Bronwyn Hancock to talk about the latest vaccine controversy. Please stand by. This is Stand By Me from the album Playing for Change. Ben E. King, Jerry Leiber, and Mike Stoller.
This song says, no matter who you are, no matter where you go in your life, at some point you're going to need somebody to stand by you. Oh yeah, oh my darling, stand by me. No matter who you are, no matter where you go in life, you gonna need somebody to stand by you. No matter how much money you got, all the friends you got, you gonna need somebody to stand by you.
When the night has come and the land is dark, and that moon is the only light we'll see. No, I won't be afraid. No, I won't shed one tear just as long as your people come and stand by me.
No, oh,
not as long as you, yeah.
Thank you, thank you.
Sick of the lies, deception, spin and half-truths? Well, so are we. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia. Tune in every week at truthnews.com.au or subscribe to the podcast with iTunes or your favourite podcatcher.
Okay, welcome back to the show. And in this section, we are going to be looking at the latest controversy in relation to vaccines. And we've done quite a lot on this topic on Truth News, and we're going to be doing a lot more, I think, because the pressure is really mounting from those who wish to stamp out dissent. And in a moment, I'm going to be bringing Bronwyn Hancock onto the show. But just before we do that, I'm going to play you a little of the late line report on the Australian Vaccination Network, which was broadcast just a couple of nights ago. So we'll kick off with that.
The New South Wales Healthcare Complaints Commission has compiled a damning report after examining Australia's most prominent anti-vaccination group, the Australian Vaccination Network. The Commission accuses the AVN of providing inaccurate and misleading information and selectively quoting research out of context to argue against vaccination. It's also noted accusations that the AVN harassed the parents of a child who died of whooping cough last year after they'd advocated the importance of childhood vaccination. The report's likely to go public within the next 2 weeks. For its part, the AVN maintains it's not an anti-vaccination network, merely wanting parents to make informed choices. Steve Kinnane reports.
Meryl Dorey runs the Australian Vaccination Network from a home office on the north coast of New South Wales. The AVN provides anti-vaccination information through their website, their magazine, and seminars. But an investigation into the AVN by the Healthcare Complaints Commission has found that the information they provide to parents is inaccurate and misleading.
This was not an independent investigation. This was an investigation by an organization that set out to support government policy, which is pro-vaccination. We do not agree that the ACCC has any jurisdiction over us, and we have been telling this from the very beginning, and we are seeking legal advice on this issue.
I think they're a bunch of rat bags. Reason and science just don't break through. They're not interested in the reality. They're interested in conspiracy theories and junk science.
Ken McLeod is the man who took the initial complaint against the AVN to the Healthcare Complaints Commission.
I remember as a six-year-old seeing the look of horror on my father's face as the doctor told him that my sister had polio and my mother being just so shattered. And I remember going to the hospital ward in Townsville to visit my sister. And it was an entire ward full of dozens of kids, little babies with polio. And it was awful, absolutely awful. And then only a year or so later, the polio vaccine came and this disappeared. It was like magic. And it was just wonderful. And then all these years later, you now find people who are trying to set the clock back 50 years. And I thought, someone's got to do something.
More and more people rely on the internet for healthcare information. If you Google vaccination, the Australian Vaccination Network comes up second on the list of sites. But nowhere on their website do they declare they are an anti-vaccination organisation.
Our position is to provide information that balances the information that parents get from their doctors and from the government. We have never said that we provide both sides of the story. We don't.
Nobel Prize-winning immunologist Professor Peter Doherty says denying children vaccines is a crime against humanity.
The reason it is a crime against humanity is it's really a crime against children. And children are vulnerable, we're responsible for them, and basically anything that will adversely affect children strikes at us as a society.
I'll just pause it there. encourage you to watch the entire piece, which we'll put on the show notes. It's on YouTube. At this point, I'd like to welcome Bronwyn Hancock to Truth News Radio. Good evening, Bronwyn.
Good evening, Herewood.
Yes, Bronwyn, you're a researcher and an activist in the area of vaccines and the problems and threats available resulting from the vaccines of many, many types that you've looked at. Would you care to respond to the last statement we had there from the doctor who said that it's a crime against humanity to basically provide information that might dissuade people from getting vaccinated? How do you respond to that charge?
Outrageous. Providing information, as long as it's truthful information, is the opposite of a crime against humanity. It's what humanity needs to support as much as possible. And he's taking that position as someone on the side that's promoting vaccines. So, yeah.
Indeed.
Going to the extreme to say so. But vaccines have been demonstrated repeatedly to be ineffective and to be very harmful. And even the government's own immunisation handbook admits deaths have been reported as an adverse event after vaccination, and there's even drug companies' own product inserts admits vaccines can cause deaths. So, for someone to be committed to be accused of a crime for warning people that about a medical procedure that can cause death. Talk about the pot calling the kettle black. The all those who provide any medical procedure or medication have a legal duty of care, and this was it's common law even if not written anyway. But it was written and documented in a high court ruling from 1992, Rogers versus Whittaker, where they ruled that any provider of any medical procedural medication have a legal duty of care to warn of all adverse effects of that procedure of a material nature from the perspective of the patient, and even if the patient does not ask. And that's common sense. Now, so this should be done time and time again, of course, every time the vaccine is given, but doctors are not doing that. So, this is where the crime is occurring, because everybody has a right to make a fully informed decision, particularly when you have a procedure which involves injecting material directly into the body. Everybody has an absolute fundamental right to know every detail about what that material is and what effect it might have.
Indeed. And just
if those who provide the procedure don't know what all the effects maybe they should say so.
Yes, if I could just ask the reason that is often given, and I've had this from many different sources, including the man we just listened to there, is that they regard it as being extremely reprehensible to discourage people from getting vaccinated, because they have this concept of herd immunity that they uphold as being vitally important to the overall effectiveness of vaccinations. In other words, it's not good enough for you to just vaccinate yourself or your kid. All the other kids have to be vaccinated as well in order to provide the so-called herd immunity. I mean, that's what I've encountered in my research. And that's why they say that any information that comes out that discourages people from being vaccinated is going to destroy the beautiful herd immunity that we can build up. So everyone has to believe that everything's okay, because if they're allowed to have doubts, those doubts might lead them to take actions which will, reduce the percentage of vaccinated people. Now, how much basis in reality does that claim have? Because that is really one of the central planks of pro-vaccination policy, wouldn't you say?
Yes. Well, I'm glad you raised this concept of herd immunity because it gives me an opportunity to say what the origin of herd immunity is, what it really means, as opposed to the twisted concept which we get constantly in the media, as you're talking about. Now, herd immunity was documented by a researcher called Hedrick in 1930s, I think it's 1933. What he did is he found that about 68% of the population had was immune to measles, an epidemic would wane, because all these infectious diseases, they come and go in cycles, and so you have your repeated troughs and peaks. And so once the certain percentage, sort of approximately 2/3, had it, his observation was that the epidemic would wane. Now, this is the 1930s, so we're talking about, 30 to 40 years before the measles vaccine even came into existence. So it had nothing to do with vaccination.
Right.
And that was his observation. Now, what the pro-vaccinators have done is they started talking about herd immunity in a completely different way, without any scientific substantiation. And they started claiming when they used the vaccine, based on the assumption of its effectiveness, unfounded, that once you had certain percentages of the population vaccinated, it would then protect the rest of the population. But this has been shown, this theory of theirs, as they define it, has been shown not to be correct, because no matter how high you get the vaccination coverage, 95, 99, even 100% vaccinated, the epidemics still occur, and they don't even occur at greater intervals between the peaks. They still occur with the no longer inter-epidemic period. So it's obviously not having any positive effect on the, reducing the occurrence of the disease at all.
Right. And of course, we've seen with all of the publicly available, widely accepted statistics and graphs that show that all the major infectious diseases declined starting in the late 19th century, and the most rapid decline was in the first part of the 20th century, where they went from just staggeringly high rates to over a period of about 50 years, just, massive decline. And during that period, when these rates of mortality from these diseases were declining, well, that was coincident with improvements in hygiene, improvements in diet, less crowded living conditions, better working hours, all of the key things that we actually know are the vital ingredients of a healthy democratic society. Those are the things that caused the deaths from diseases to decrease.
Yeah, which is why, obviously that happened before vaccinations were introduced, so that in itself shows that vaccines are not responsible. And then, of course, in addition to that, diseases that were very prevalent a couple of hundred years ago, are now virtually unheard of, the diseases for which vaccines were never even introduced. Or if they were, some of them, they were at some stage developed but never really used, scarlet fever. We've never had any real vaccination against scarlet fever, any vaccination programs. Typhoid, we have a typhoid vaccine, but, only a small portion of the population's ever had a typhoid vaccine. It was never part of the vaccination schedule.
Indeed. I actually had it a few times. I travelled a bit when I was young, and I did get the typhoid vaccine a few times.
But it's not part of the vaccination schedule.
It certainly didn't. In fact, my whole family got typhoid.
Same cholera, yeah. Typhoid and cholera are, those diseases are linked to, you know, not having a good clean water supply.
Right, yeah.
So, which is along the lines of what you're talking about. So, as you said, these diseases that dramatically decline before the introduction of vaccines, and with some, you can actually see a counterproductive effect of the vaccine. So, and whooping cough is a primary example of that, because it was going down in the United States until 1978, and then the state governments, in their infinite wisdom, made the vaccination compulsory for school entry, and at that point, curiously, the decline slowed, stopped, turned round, and it's been going up ever since.
Right.
So, you know, so much for positive effect of vaccines. So, and we've had a similar thing happening here, which is that in the late 1990s, the federal government linked vaccination to maternity and childcare allowances. Now, people can still put in a conscientious objector form if they're normally eligible for those payments. Otherwise, they want to get them without vaccinating, that's fine. They can put in the conscientious objector form and get the full payments. But parents are not being properly informed about that. Many, you know, have been told by Centrelink that they just have to have their children vaccinated to get those payments, full stop, and not even informed of the alternatives, which is very poor. Anyway, as one expects, which is obviously the purpose of introducing that legislation, that caused an increase in vaccination coverage since that time. That was introduced in October 97. And curiously, what's been happening since is that whooping cough has been rising. And in this last epidemic that we had, whooping cough comes around, the epidemics every 44 months on average. It varies a bit. It could be, you know, about 2 to 3 years or 5 years, but generally it's around every 4 years. The last epidemic that we had, they were reporting a year ago that the number of cases in 2008 was the highest in 20 years.
Right.
And doctors were scratching their heads, couldn't figure out why we're having such a high number of cases. And of course, neither was the inter-epidemic period being lengthened by this high vaccination coverage. So here they're all scratching their heads about this. But they shouldn't be surprised, because, you know, this has been reported elsewhere in the world with vaccination, such as what I was talking about with the US. And also, interesting thing happened in Sweden when they weren't vaccinating for over a decade, and then they did a trial of the whooping cough vaccine, and they had to terminate the trial early because they had this big epidemic of whooping cough after 6 months in these vaccinated babies. And I still ended up using the vaccine because there was the powers that be, but they had to finish the trial early for that reason. So, and of course, this is in vaccinated babies under 12 months of age, and this is following the research that was published where they had looked at 372 unvaccinated children who had 10-year-old children, so had been born just after they stopped vaccination in Sweden at the end of the 1970s, and they looked at what ages that they'd contracted whooping cough, and none of them had contracted it under 12 months of age.
Right.
And yet, whooping cough, the hype that we get in the media is that vaccination is important to protect these under 12 months
now,
age.
Just on this question of age, because a large part of the story, and we didn't play the entire late line piece, but the second part of it is actually The investigation that was conducted by the ACCC, which is the Healthcare Something Commission, anyway, so it's a government body. They were also under pressure from the parents of a little girl who died, and she was only like a newborn, really, like I think she was 30 days old or something like that. Is that about right?
Old, I think.
Right. Okay, and she was too young to actually get the standard whooping cough vaccine. But now, and this is where I just want to bring in my criticism of the ABC's reporting style here, because they strongly imply in this piece that this little girl died because she was living, her parents were living in an area of very low vaccination rates, and that somehow led to her getting the illness. Now, Meryl Dorey apparently wanted to do some research on her own to determine whether or not the little girl really did die of whooping cough, and the parents of the little girl have interpreted her actions as harassment, and that's the way it's actually portrayed in the piece, and that seems to be their opinion about it. That's in a way a separate issue, but I mean, let's just look at the question of her age, and let's just accept at face value that she did die of whooping cough. Well, she's under the age of being vaccinated. Well, if there's a problem, then surely the problem is with the government's policies and procedures. If they don't think she should have been vaccinated, they're then shifting the blame, or the emphasis of the journalistic intent behind this article is to somehow shift the blame to unvaccinated kids. But it gets back to that claim that we've had again about the herd immunity, et cetera, you know, being a crime against humanity. But look, it's so frustrating here, because I mean, we have a death which is tragic, and obviously a problem. We have a person who's a campaigner who claims to want to help people, and with absolute, you know, conviction that she is actually trying to find the truth. Her action is interpreted as harassment because she wants to find out whether the child really died of a particular disease. The child hasn't been vaccinated because the government said you're not to be vaccinated. I don't quite understand this whole story, because, I mean, if the government thinks that children shouldn't be vaccinated before 2 months, then they're going to be vulnerable to the whooping cough virus or bacteria or whatever it is. Sorry.
Well, the government's position is that the little ones are too young to be vaccinated, and therefore they rely on the rest of the population to be vaccinated so that they don't pass it whooping cough to them. But that's all theory. I think what we really need to get down to here is the published facts, what the reality is, not what the theory is.
Indeed.
And the reality is demonstrated by a classic, this is typical, it's demonstrated by this article published in the Medical Journal of Australia in March 98, which concerned the whooping cough epidemic that occurred, had just occurred. That was the one that occurred 1996 to 97. And there were four infant whooping cough deaths in New South Wales, and they looked into these cases. So what they found was that in at least three, possibly all cases, they had contracted the infection from their fully vaccinated sibling and or mother. So the conclusion drawn, about which they were warning doctors, was that doctors shouldn't assume that because someone's vaccinated they can't have whooping cough. Doctors make that assumption time and time again and will diagnose the disease as something else, such as croup.
Right.
And so that's one interesting finding, and also these infants' mothers, as a result of having been vaccinated as children, had poor or no passive immunity to pass to their newborns via the placenta. This problem was published in The Lancet in 1995, research called Holland et al. And this problem, obviously, this makes the infant susceptible to what is traditionally a disease of older children, for whom it's documented to be beneficial in priming the immune system, but it's making these little infants susceptible to getting it when they're still quite, very young. So, the ideal age to get any child disease, including whooping cough, is between about, 2 or 3 and 10 years of age. And that's the right time in the process of development of the immune system, when it's a good exercise. And it's not deadly, of course, provided it's properly managed, properly dealt with. Just like exercise is not deadly, provided we do that sensibly. It's the same sort of thing. Some people have died from, running in the city to surf. Does that mean we should all stop exercising?
Yeah.
Obviously not. These infectious diseases are there to prime and mature the immune system, and provided we're sensible with them, and obviously, we're not, malnourished, and we don't do silly things, and talking about managed malnutrition, I'll tell you what happened with these babies in a minute. Provided we're not, then they actually have a beneficial effect. And whooping cough, for example, has been documented to benefit, strengthen the respiratory system, because it's been found to protect against asthma. If whooping cough is badly managed, then it could increase the risk of asthma or other respiratory infections. So, it comes down to management, of course. But what happened with these infants that it was being reported on in this article was that they weren't even in that serious condition when they were admitted to hospital, but they were then administered high doses of intravenous antibiotics that had already been demonstrated to be dangerous for infants under 1 year of age. It was only then that they deteriorated and died.
My God.
And yet what gets blamed? Whooping cough.
Hmm.
So the moral of the story is that, obviously, I think people listening to your program would be aware is you can't rely on what's in the media. There's always much more to the story than meets the eye. And when one learns much more of the story, then one often finds that the reality is actually the opposite of this superficial message that the story may appear to be conveying.
Indeed, and I mean, I just like to say that I totally empathise with people who've lost a child, and I totally understand that their grief must be just appalling, right? Mm-hmm. And I can sort of understand that they're angry, But I really do feel that they're directing their anger at Meryl Dorey is somehow unwarranted in that, I mean, she clearly had nothing to do with their child's death. And there's no indication that Meryl repeatedly called them or did what you normally would define as harassment, which is calling someone over and over again. I think she contacted them once and I think she contacted the hospital. As an independent researcher, that is something that as free citizens in a free country, we are actually entitled to do that kind of thing.
Well,
that's my opinion.
Enough for her to get to the bottom of the truth is to be what methods you use to diagnose whooping cough. So I don't see how that could be offensive. And Dan's mother made a curious claim that Meryl Dorey expecting her to prove that she died of whooping cough. Well, there was no evidence that she was asking her to prove anything. She's just the mother of the baby. The only evidence came out that she was asking the doctors to for information as to what methods they had for diagnosing her zinc off. She wasn't asking the mother to prove anything.
Indeed, and I think there's a fair amount of spin there again in the late line piece. And just, we don't really have much time left for this interview. I just want to highlight two really important points for free speech in our society. One being that in the late line piece, they emphasise the fact that if you put in vaccination into Google, that the Australian Vaccination Network comes up at number two. Now, they didn't make a judgment of that, but again, the implication was that because they presented the story as being, well, this organisation has been, you know, found to be in breach and giving false information. Then they show you, oh, it shows number two in Google. There must be something wrong with Google. There must be something wrong with the internet. That's the underlying implication of what they're saying. And this is a really big problem, folks, because it's actually the opposite of the way they're portraying it. The fact that that website comes up at number two in Google should be taken as extremely strong evidence that website is an important and valuable piece of the online information about vaccination. Google does not trivially compile its algorithms for the importance of websites. It's a really complex algorithm which has taken, you know, a decade to develop, and it's extremely effective. So I ask you, why is it that the Australian Vaccination Network is number two? Why isn't one of the pro-vaccination sites at number two? Because they're not as important, as relevant. They don't have as many links to them. In other words, they don't provide the sort of valuable information relevant to the topic.
Mm.
Secondly, the recommendation from the report that has been done into the Australian Vaccination Network has said that she should put a disclaimer on her website saying that it is not medical advice and that this website is an anti-vaccination website. Now, what is interesting about this, I'll tell you, Bronwyn, from my having looked at the documentation and everything, I've downloaded the file, and we'll put those on the show notes so everyone can have a look at it. This organisation actually has no coercive power at all. There is no coercive power that they have. But the story is being portrayed as if they do, and it may well be a next step that the government or some other association will try to invoke some other law based on their recommendation to put pressure on her to comply with this directive. But if we allow that to go through, everyone who's concerned about free speech on any topic should realise that this is a line in the sand that we can't allow to happen, because there are websites, and my website Truth News goes into a whole lot of topics which are regarded as taboo, right, in the media, and that there could be all kinds of situations where someone might say that the information that I'm providing is dangerous because it's, you know, giving people incorrect facts, and they might say to me, "You are not really a journalist. You're not a journalist. Therefore, you've got to put a disclaimer on your website on truthnews.com.au. This is not a real media site, and I'm anti-government."
Mm.
They could force people to do that simply on the basis of the fact that they don't like what it is you have to say. So it looks to me mostly bluff at this stage. But if it does come to the point where there is an attempt to actually coerce Merrill Dorey into doing this, then we really need to wake up. All the movements of freedom and justice and truth in this country need to come together on this. If that actually happens, I'm quite willing to hold the torch there for everyone to come together on this. If it does come to that point. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here. Sorry, can you ask any questions?
No, I'm done. I've had my rant.
Yes. Well, Merrill says that her organisation is not anti-vaccine because she believes that everybody has a choice whether or not to vaccinate. So she says she's libertarian, and everybody obviously is well, we're inundated with information, the information that's provided by the other side. So it's not like we're short on it, is it?
Indeed. It's
So, you know, to make out as if she's only providing one side, as if people somehow are not going to have the benefit of what is provided by the government, is just absolutely absurd. Because, you know, you just can't even turn on your radio or the TV or read a newspaper. Usually somewhere along the way, within a week or a few weeks, you'll get some article that's promoting vaccination somewhere or another. And of course, or go to the doctor, I should say, hear announcements about new vaccination being introduced by the government, without being getting constantly this message that we're being told that vaccines are supposedly very safe and effective and even important and necessary.
Exactly.
And, you know, we're getting inundated with that now. The ACCC made a comment that if you do a search, then that organisation, you know, will come up second. So that the internet's a primary source for people looking for information. Well, that's actively looking information. The only way to get information that's counters what we get from the government, medical profession, etc., is by doing an active search, which very few people actually do, relatively.
Indeed.
But if you don't do any search, if you don't do any active search whatsoever, you only get the pro-vaccination site. So, yeah, it actually requires activity to do a search on Google. And if we don't do a search, you know, we don't get a...
Well, the difference with Google is, well, the difference with the internet generally is it is a proactive environment, you know.
Proactive.
It doesn't just broadcast to you.
It relies on being active.
Yeah. So by contrast, the older methods of media are basically you sit at home and whatever the television broadcast companies want to tell you is what you sort of then believe is the truth. And, of course, they're all owned by a tiny little group of powerful people, monopolies. They're all just massive monopolies. Mm. And if you expect you're going to get, you know, correct information from that, you've got to be crazy, you know.
Yeah, these are passive forms of people getting information because they don't do anything. It just comes in automatically. And obviously those who control those forms of media are going to be much more powerful and influential in affecting people's knowledge on a subject than any source on the internet for which you actually have to do a search actively. Goes without saying.
And hence the effort to try and to silence the voices of people who are on the internet because it is a problem. And here we are. You know, we're on the internet right now. That's how people are getting this podcast. And we just have to keep doing it and keep fighting this this fight of truth and in a non-violent but very focused and relentless way. We have to fight for truth.
Absolutely.
Look, we're going to have to wind it up, Bronwyn. Thanks so much for coming on tonight.
No worries.
And, I'll keep following this story and I'll look forward to getting another interview and getting into more depth at some point.
Yep, absolutely. There's always plenty more to talk about.
Great.
Bye. on this subject.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Herowood.
Yeah. Thanks a lot. Good night.
Bye.
Cheers. Okay. Well, that was Bronwyn Hancock. Terrific person. Very calm, thoughtful, and focused in her research. Just want to emphasize that for those who've been given the impression that people who are anti-vaccine are some kind of crazy, you know, people with just paranoid attitudes or whatever. It ain't so. And what we're doing on this show is presenting information in a straightforward way. You know, we even try to have a sense of humour. And it just happens to be at the fringe of what certain groups, certain minority bloated power groups want to be the norm. But that's just a condition of the times we're living in. That's not to be considered in any way the nature of reality, the nature of the way that the things have to be, the nature of the way society has to be. It's just an unfortunate situation. So on that note, I wish you all a good night, and I hope you enjoyed the show tonight. Cheers from Truth News Radio Australia.